ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Ngunnawal Country, Canberra. Tonight, a surge in employment and migration. What does that mean for those hanging out for interest rate cuts? Also, as flooding hits remote communities in the Northern Territory, residents wait to find out if their homes have been inundated. And one baby platypus sparks new hope for a team of conservationists.
She's perfect. You know, like, she's 850 grams. She's got a lot of fat on her, and so she's looking great.
It's amazing to have evidence of breeding this early on, and really is encouraging for the long-term future of that population.
Thanks for your company. There was a surprise result on unemployment today. It's travelling much better than expected. Despite 13 Reserve Bank interest rate rises since May 2022 and economic growth now at a crawl, the jobless rate fell sharply from 4.1% to 3.7%. It's all the more surprising when you consider news today that net overseas migration rose 60% to almost 550,000 people in the year to September, taking Australia's population close to 27 million. There are downsides. The population surge is putting more pressure on housing and infrastructure, and the impressive jobless figure could mean a longer wait for interest rate cuts. Business reporter David Taylor explains.
The professionals who make a living placing candidates into jobs say the post-pandemic jobs boom still hasn't come to an end. Not yet, anyway.
The world at large shut down. Well, it's reopened, and it's reopened with gusto.
That's Nicole Gorton from recruitment firm Robert Half. She says there's hot demand for workers in pockets of the economy.
You know, whether it relates to hospitality, travel, leisure, all of these areas are back, and they're back with a vengeance.
The latest data from the Bureau of Statistics shows 116,000 Australians found work in February, pulling the unemployment rate down from 4.1% to 3.7%. Full-time jobs increased by 78,200, and the number of unemployed people fell by 52,000. Employment and Workplace Relations Minister Tony Burke says the better-than-expected employment numbers couldn't have come at a better time.
At a time when people are doing it tough in so many ways, to have people have a job is possibly one of the most important things of all.
But here's the problem. While the government is happy to report more Australians finding work, the Reserve Bank wants to see lower inflation. And generally speaking, lower unemployment leads to higher inflation. Tony Burke was asked today if he thought higher unemployment was necessary for the RBA to achieve its goals.
The Reserve Bank will be looking at not only at the headline rates, but also at the trend rates. And so there's still a softening going on throughout the economy.
Recruiter Nicole Gorton is already seeing demand for skilled workers fall.
The verticals in which we recruit at Robert Half are finance and accounting, risk and compliance, technology, being infrastructure, business transformation, cloud migration, cybersecurity, and business support, HR. Those roles, we are seeing a decline in demand in that space.
RBC Capital Markets Chief Economist Su Lin Ong says many Australians who registered as unemployed in December and January did have jobs lined up in February, which explains the up and down nature of the data. But she's not confident the jobs bonanza can last.
We know there's a weakening in vacancies. We know there's a lift in applications for each ad. We also know that there is some softness in employer sentiment from businesses, and the overall labour market is clearly quite weak. So from that perspective, we would expect a rising unemployment rate over the course of this year.
In addition to this, net overseas migration grew 60% in the year to September, the majority of which are temporary visa holders like foreign students, according to ABS figures today. With fewer available jobs and an ongoing housing crisis, ANU demographer Liz Allen says the coming months could could be challenging for migrants.
Many people who are newly migrated to Australia will generally stay in shared housing or something similar when they first establish themselves and then move on after that.
Is that experience a positive one, or can it come with real challenges?
It is scary, and I think increasingly, particularly post-COVID and particularly given the increase in the number of arrivals to Australia, migrants are going to be confronted with potentially a hostile welcome.
In Question Time today, the opposition accused the government of economic mismanagement by boosting migration during a housing crisis. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, responded by saying recent policy changes mean net migration numbers will be lower in coming months.
So we're taking action when it comes to net overseas migration, but we recognise that it is largely a story about students and the strength of our university sector. When it comes to housing, if those opposite were serious about the housing shortage in this country, they'd vote to help fix it.
So where does all this leave the direction of interest rates? Well, many economists have pushed back their expectations of the Reserve Bank's first interest rate cut from August to September.
David Taylor there. Turning now to the flooding that's hit parts of the Northern Territory. Many of the residents in the remote mining town of Borroloola face an anxious wait, with a fair chance their homes will be inundated by the swollen MacArthur River. The river's already risen 3 metres higher than its last major peak 23 years ago. And once again, NT government authorities are facing criticism from locals for making a late decision to evacuate people. Jane Barden reports.
Borroloola resident Osman Rory counts his young family as lucky. They're among 100 people flown out of the remote NT Gulf of Carpentaria community of 800 last night on a government evacuation plane to Darwin.
You know, just to see the river rise in 24 hours, not to mention going through the cyclone, the winds of destructive force, it was too stressful. I was worried about my kids.
On Monday, they waited hours for an air evacuation, which had to be aborted as Cyclone Megan approached. The second decision to evacuate last night was too late for most people to get out.
We've got other family members back home that's still trying to get evacuated out. My home's probably going to be underwater on the other side of Garawa Camp. You know, the whole of our family stuff in there, you know. Not to mention my mother-in-law house. When we left yesterday, we could throw our lines at the back of it. I could have caught a red tag, mate, and that's how close that water was.
The last-minute evacuation decision meant Borroloola resident Joni Wilson had to leave with no notice.
The bus came and beeped the horn outside my house. I didn't know that they were picking people up or evacuating. Lucky we had our bags packed from the day before. And we just all jumped onto the bus to go to the airport. From the bus, we had to jump on a boat, get off the boat, and then on a car again, and then on the plane. My house has crossed the river. They said the water's there now.
What do you feel about knowing that the water's come to your house?
I just feel, like, sad and depressed and angry, and it's all a mixed emotions all in one.
Do you think that there's anything that some of the authorities should have done earlier?
Just to warn us about that we're going to have major floodings. And, you know, if I knew that, I would have went home and put things up higher, you know, I could save some things.
NT Police Commissioner Michael Murphy says this second evacuation was late because the Weather Bureau has not been able to monitor the MacArthur River heights since phone and internet lines went down in Borroloola on Wednesday.
They reached out to the MacArthur River mine and they provided some more information which indicated the volume of water was much more significant than we originally thought.
NT Police Incident Controller Matt Hollenby says an air evacuation of Borroloola resumed this afternoon.
There is another aircraft that's about to land in Borroloola and another plane is scheduled to.
The flooding has also caused havoc upstream on Glencore's massive MacArthur River lead zinc mine, which has had to suspend operations. After the ABC heard from locals that some workers had been stranded on part of the mine site, Glencore provided a statement. It says 200 of its staff had to spend the night in operational buildings, cut off from the accommodation village. 60 have now been flown out by helicopter, and the company is now building a new route to get the others out. Matt Hollenby from NT Police again.
The people there are safe, and we will support them as best we can in the circumstances.
The Federal Emergency Services Minister Murray Watt was today quick to offer evacuations from other NT communities facing flooding in the Victoria River and Barkly areas,
such as Timber Creek, Pigeon Hole, Kalkarindji, and we expect that that will begin later in the day, subject to weather conditions.
Matt Hollenby says that may be needed later.
Borroloola is the only community that is being evacuated at this point in time. There are plans, emergency plans, to evacuate other communities only if it's necessary.
The chief executive of the Victoria Daily Regional Council, Brian Highlands, thinks evacuations from his area may not be possible.
I don't know if the ADF planes would be able to land in Timber Creek and possibly only Kalkarindji they could land. So, yeah, it's a logistical nightmare to move people around for those planes to land in some of our communities.
He says many Victoria Daily communities have had continual minor flooding and threats this wet, and some are running short of food.
We've been suffering flooding conditions for the last 2 months. So do we expect it to be any worse than it's been? It was hard to know, and I don't think the Bureau of Meteorology can tell us either way. It's just an ongoing saga, really.
Yeah, it sure is. That's Victoria Daily Regional Council Chief Executive Brian Highlands. He was speaking to our reporter Jane Barden. Well, just a few days after the government celebrated news that power prices might be coming down for many energy users, there's been a warning about trouble ahead. Households and businesses across southern Australia could be up for rising power and heating bills in a few years' time because of a looming gas shortage. The Australian energy market operator, AEMO, is forecasting a shortage of gas as soon as 2026 as supplies from the Bass Strait dry up. But not everyone is convinced the shortage will bite so hard. Here's John Daly.
Manufacturers in southern Australia are nervous about the years ahead. They're facing another gas shortage from 2026 to 2028 as major gas production from Victoria's Bass Strait enters its twilight years. Andrew Richards is Chief Executive of the Energy Users Association of Australia, which represents industrial gas users.
It's very uncertain as to the future of that fuel. And now we need a bit more guidance from government, a bit more pragmatic view of the world in saying, well, yes, we may want to move away from gas, but recognise we can't do that completely. And we still need to be able to support those businesses and households that will continue to use gas. So it's one thing to say, let's get rid of gas in a press release. It's very difficult to do it in reality, and that's what we're finding.
Andrew Richards says electrification just isn't an option right now for heavy industry.
Even if there is an alternative, it's still very expensive to switch. So that's why it's going to take quite some time to move away from gas.
The Australian energy market operator, AEMO, has warned of gas shortages from 2028 in southern states. Seasonal supply issues could start as soon as 2026, as production from the giant Longford gas plant in Victoria begins to dwindle. AEMO says urgent new investment in gas supply is needed, claiming gas will still play an essential role in the Australian energy transition. But some analysts aren't convinced. Kevin Morrison is a gas analyst from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
They publish this report each year, and each year we always find there's going to be this impending gas shortage. But this shortage never arrives. I mean, for a start, Eastern Australia is awash with gas. It's just that we happen to send three-quarters of it overseas. This report is really just looking from a supply side, but there's a lot of things happening on the demand side.
Kevin Morrison says AEMO keeps overestimating the role gas-fired power stations will play in electricity generation. He says last year's forecast is a case in point.
It was way over forecast. I mean, it was actually 54% higher than what the actual sort of gas use in power generation was.
That's because of the rising role of solar, wind and battery technologies in the grid. Kevin Morrison says the other factor reducing demand for gas is the electrification of households, mainly for heating and cooking appliances.
AEMO, but they also released another report, and that was just focused on Victoria. And what it found was that the gas demand in Victorian households, as well as small business, actually declined last year.
AEMO's forecast of a gas shortage does still have energy consumer advocates worried, though. Jacqueline Crawshaw is Policy Director at Energy Consumers Australia, which represents households and small businesses. She is concerned power bills will rise again if that shortage eventuates.
We've seen this play out previously. So we're just coming off the high of high electricity prices, which was, as you know, a result of the high gas prices. These sorts of announcements like we heard today from the market operator are concerning for us. We're worried about how that's going to impact prices. So we need to be thinking now about how we can enable households to make the right decision for them.
Jacqueline Crawshaw says governments need to play a greater role in accelerating the electrification of homes.
Moving a house from one that uses fossil fuels to going all electric is challenging. You know, you might be thinking about how and when to replace a gas cooktop or your hot water service. Should you buy an EV? These are all hard decisions and people need help. That information piece is really critical, building up that agency so consumers can make the right decision for them, but also finding some financial support for those who don't have the means to be able to make those investments because they can be really expensive. And then lastly, as I said earlier, thinking about where the legislation or the red tape lies that is preventing households who do have the means from being able to make those investments.
The federal government says its introduction of a mandatory code of conduct and reforms to the domestic gas security mechanism are helping shore up domestic supply.
John Daly reporting. You're listening to PM. I'm David Lipson. You can hear all of our programs live or later via the ABC Listen app. Well, yesterday it was China. Today, the federal government welcomed top British officials to Canberra. The UK's Defence and Foreign Secretaries are meeting their Australian counterparts here as part of the AUKMIN talks. A new pact has been signed, the first formal defence treaty between the two nations, that'll make it easier for Australian and British military personnel to operate in each other's countries. There'll also be greater cooperation on drone technology to help Ukraine in the war against Russia. The ABC's defence correspondent Andrew Green is covering the visit. Andrew, we are already incredibly close to Britain, obviously, and even more so since the AUKUS agreement. So what does today's defence agreement actually achieve in practice?
In a way, it formalises what's been going on for decades, perhaps even over a century. Australia and the United Kingdom have a very long history together. They've served in world wars. But what we haven't seen until now is this formal status of agreement. Australia has similar arrangements with the United States. The United Kingdom has similar arrangements with all its NATO partners. But until now, Australia and the UK hadn't. It will formalise things like costs and which laws will apply to defence personnel when they operate in each other's countries. But it is a sign of the growing strategic alliance between Australia and its AUKUS partner, the United Kingdom. Let's hear from the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, who is hosting his British counterpart, Grant Shapps, here in Australia before both of these men travel to Adelaide for a bigger meeting with the Foreign Minister Penny Wong and the UK Foreign Secretary.
Whilst the UK is our oldest relationship, what we are experiencing right now is a strategic dimension to the contemporary relationship, which in many respects is unprecedented, but certainly has not been in place for decades.
The thing which has struck me most in my first few hours with you here today is the extent to which distance is absolutely no object to us at all, because we stand united in our view of the world and what needs to be done.
That's the UK Defence Secretary Grant Shapps, and before that, Richard Marles. We're also, Andrew, joining this drone coalition. Now, this is all about Ukraine, isn't it?
That's right. Australia is part of a number of coalitions and groupings already to do with Ukraine. The UK has a fund that it administers, and Australia contributes financially to that. At the same time, Australia's running a training program in the south of England, training Ukrainian recruits. That's a UK-led multi-nation operation. Several countries are there helping to train soldiers, get basic combat training, and then head straight to the front line. Today, we've also signed up to another coalition, a drone coalition, providing unmanned or uncrewed aerial systems to Ukraine's armed forces. And that has the benefit of helping Ukraine fight against Russia's invasion. But as the UK Defence Secretary said today, it will also provide valuable experience for Australia in terms of military drones here and civil drones as well.
Well, it's the war in Ukraine, or more specifically Russia's aggression, really, that's at the heart of this agreement also announced today and broken by your good self, the news, to supply Germany with 100 armoured combat vehicles, all to be built in Queensland.
This is a bit of a surprise, this one. It was first flagged by Prime Minister Anthony Albanese during a visit to Berlin last year, something like a $1 billion deal, which he touted as the biggest export defence single export deal for Australia on record. Then Australia decided to award a more lucrative contract to South Korea that Germany was competing for. Many thought that Germany would scrap this export deal, which was seen as a sweetener. It didn't do that. And today we've got confirmation that the German parliament has in fact approved this export deal. So Australia will assemble the vehicles outside Queensland using many German parts and then ship the completed vehicles back to Europe. The defence industry minister, Pat Conroy, is very happy about the result.
Beyond the 600 workers in the factory, there are 300 Australian companies that supply parts for it. New Press in my home, Electric in Cardiff, Morand Engineering in Melbourne, Blue Scope and Bizalloy work on the steel. So this is an Australian product, and we should be really proud. We're selling one of the most advanced combat vehicles to Germany, and it's going to employ over 1,000 Australians directly and indirectly and contribute over $1 billion to our balance of trade.
That's the Defence Industry Minister, Pat Conroy, and before him, our Defence Correspondent, Andrew Green. If you rent your home, you may want to listen in. A new government task force has been established to crack down on landlords and estate agents doing the wrong thing. The Victorian Task Force will enforce existing laws upholding renters' rights to a structurally sound, functional property and clamp down on false or misleading advertising by agents. Oliver Gordon reports.
Jordy Vandenberg has amassed tens of thousands of followers, documenting decrepit Melbourne rental properties on social media.
I don't know if you can see that, but the whole house is kind of falling away from the fireplace.
In this video, he's showing a house in Melbourne's inner north that appears to be structurally unsound.
The house is kind of held together by duct tape, which is really great.
I've seen more mould than I would care to admit. I've seen, you know, water kind of coming up through the floors onto the carpet. I've seen asbestos on cooking surfaces.
After years telling the stories of Melbourne's rental crisis, he's welcomed the announcement of a new rental task force. But we'll wait to see how it actually functions before celebrating.
It depends on how they kind of get their intelligence, but I think it'll have a pretty big impact. I don't know whether the funding is enough, but we'll see where it goes from there. I think we'll start to see people reporting these things to Consumer Affairs and hopefully some action.
The body's main task will be to enforce already existing rental laws, stopping false advertising and ensuring properties are structurally sound, have lockable doors and functional kitchens. Jordy Vandenberg again.
If your investment property doesn't meet those standards, you've got a problem. And if you can't afford to fix them, I think you should sell your house.
Better Renting's Joel Dignam says Victoria is the first state to create a dedicated task force to enforce renters' rights.
We don't see stuff like this in other states and territories, and that's been a big gap because there have been lots of positive changes in rental laws, but we are, unfortunately, landlords, they're a pretty atomised group. Lots of individual people don't necessarily know what those changes are, and so there are big issues out there with non-compliance.
This month, the national vacancy rate, which measures the percentage of rental homes that are vacant, hit a record low of 0.7%. The increasingly tight market has seen prices soar for some tenants, something Joel says this task force won't tackle.
The task force isn't going to resolve the challenges around rent increases and the frustrations that renters have there. And I think the current system in Victoria isn't really working either.
Victorian tenants have been flooding Consumer Affairs with complaints about rent increases in recent years. Joel Dignam says if the Victorian government wanted to further protect renters, it could follow the ACT, where landlords can only increase the rent by 10% more than the increase in the Consumer Price Index.
We've seen it work in the ACT, and I think if Victoria shifted towards a simple rule, that gives both landlords and renters clarity and I think would helpfully avoid some of these applications because people could know up front, is this rent increase reasonable or not?
President of the Real Estate Institute of Victoria, Jacob Kane, has welcomed the task force.
There are still some people out there that even when they know the regulations aren't putting them in place, aren't following the regulations, and any additional enforcement measures or accountability in that space is only going to make renting in Victoria a better experience than it might be at the moment.
But he's concerned too few Victorians, be they landlords or tenants, know what their rights and responsibilities are, which could see the new body jammed up.
There's confusion about what's okay and what's not okay, and Consumer Affairs needs to do a much better job of educating the public about that.
The task force is expected to be up and running in the coming months.
Oliver Gordon there. A small furry bundle of joy has arrived in Australia's oldest national park, to the great delight of a team of conservationists. The birth of a healthy baby platypus is a sign of success for an effort to revive the population half a century after it became locally extinct. The team says the project holds important lessons for future efforts to translocate Australian wildlife and protect more of them. Here's Jacqueline Breen.
Just south of Sydney, in the Royal National Park, researchers wearing head torches are peering at a small, glossy platypus they've just fished out of the dark water. They're checking to see if it's an adult or a juvenile. It's a girl, around 6 months old.
Oh, that's so special.
Wow.
Looking happy and healthy, according to University of New South Wales ecologist Gillard Bino.
She's perfect, you know, like just she's 850 grams, like great weight. She's got a lot of fat on her. And so the mom's, like whoever the mom was, has definitely been spending a lot of time feeding her baby. And she's looking great.
It's been less than a year since 10 adult platypuses taken from across southern New South Wales were introduced by Dr. Bino and his team back into a part of the country from which they disappeared.
Platypus populations have been on the decline for, you know, the past 50 plus years, if not longer.
Taronga Zoo Conservation Officer Phoebe Ma was part of the project.
And sadly, they're just getting further impacted by drought and floods and fire and all those climatic impacts that we've seen. Their waterways are drying up and they've got nowhere to go.
After a health check at Taronga Zoo, 6 females and then 4 males were released into the Royal National Park carrying tiny acoustic trackers.
It's about the size of like a paracetamol capsule, and that has a battery life of up to 3 years, and it means every time they swim past a receiver, we get an alert that that number platypus has swum past. We also had radio tags externally attached, and that allows us to pick up individual platypus within the park and where they are, where their burrow location is, and where they're swimming.
9 out of the 10 adults released last May have shown up recently on the trackers. The hope is that the 10th has just swum out of range for now, as she apparently tends to do.
The measure of success for this project initially was 40% or 50% survivability of that population. So that's about average for mammal translocations in Australia. So to get our first measure of success at having, you know, 90-100%, depending on when you're checking the receivers, of survivability a year on was, you know, one huge tick in terms of a measure of success. But then to have breeding so soon, so it's amazing to have evidence of breeding this early on, and really is encouraging for us for the long-term future of that population.
She credits the project's success so far to great teamwork and planning. Project lead Gillard Bino says 12 months of work went into testing water quality and other conditions in Royal National Park before the animals were released there. The hope is that the lessons learned from this success so far will help other translocation efforts. That's the movement of animals with the help of humans when a population or habitat is at the brink. To learn more about breeding patterns and the population's genetic health, the next step is genetic testing of the juvenile, or potentially juveniles.
There are three females actually that, from our tracking data and the way that the behavior, there might be three moms in the park, so this juvenile that we caught might not be necessarily the only one.
The team gave this one a name with the help of local Indigenous elder, Uncle Dean Kelly.
He bestowed the name of Gili onto her, which means fire in the Daro language. And the meaning is really like the life or fire that's been ignited in the park.
That's ecologist Gillard Binot ending that report by Jacqueline Breen and Brooke Chandler. That's the program for today. Thanks for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. I'll be back with the team tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When one of China's most senior figures came to Australia this week, it was one unofficial meeting that really stuck out. Wang Yi was very keen to meet former Prime Minister Paul Keating. Today, Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts on what China's playing at. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.